Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 10th, 1996. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Jim Farrell. Today, he will be continuing his series on moral ecology. Today's session number is 8 and is titled Working, the Moral Ecology of Jobs. Let's listen in.
I'm Jim Farrell. This is a session on called Working, the Moral Ecology of Jobs. And I need for you to know at the beginning of this that I'm utterly unqualified to talk about this because I'm a college professor. And, you know, we don't work that much. What we do is mostly play. And I'm also even more than that or worse than that. I'm a professor of American Studies and do mostly contemporary culture kinds of things. So anytime I am playing in the United States or elsewhere, since I am an American, I am the subject for study, and all I have to do is think about what I'm doing, and I can say, well, I'm at work. But in fact, it can be play. So Bruce saw me walking up and down to Honeymoon Heights today. This was part of my profession, thinking about why Americans do the things that they do. The only thing that even marginally qualifies me for this talk today is that I was on Garbo this morning. So I have experienced work. But what I want to do is to think about a whole variety of questions and to sort of hint at some answers today, but probably not to give any answers. And here are some questions that I think are important in thinking about work. The first one is the question that I've used before. It's the title of a Wendell Berry book. And it seems to me to be the first question you need to ask about, or sort of big question you need to ask, before you can ask the smaller questions on particular topics. And his question is, what are people for? Once you figure out what the answer to that question is, which I'm not going to do, what are people for, then you can think about what is work for. We can think about how was work invented in American culture. How do dead people direct our work, in a way, since the structures of work that we now inhabit are largely made by dead people. Dead people are structuring our work. What ideas and assumptions do we have about work? Where did they come from? How have they been institutionalized? How do these ideas and assumptions and institutions help us or hinder us in our pursuit of happiness? What's the connection, if any, between religion and work? In brief, is work working for us? And then those are sort of at the cultural level, the kinds of questions that we might ask. At a personal level, since probably all of you anyway are experienced with work in ways that I'm not, you could ask questions like this. What good am I? What am I good at? Which I think has something to do with work. What good is this job that I might have? What in the world is this job good for? And what good is this job for the world? These seem to me to be real important questions that we could ask about work. My general sense in thinking about work in answer to the question, is work working for us, is that in contemporary American culture, it's not. In many ways, I think it's pathological, and I think it's connected to a lot of different social problems that we have in the United States, or that we think we have, from education to drugs to family values, to the decline of community. And yet it's interesting to me that we very seldom talk about work in American politics. It seems to me to be one of the most important issues, but for the most part, we don't talk about work, we talk about jobs. And we seem to think that a certain quantity of jobs is fine. We don't need to think about the quality of work very much. This page, I'll just tell you, is kind of a historical synthesis of where work came from. And I'm going to just skip it for now. If somebody later on thinks, you know, say 10 minutes from now, thinks I would really like to know that historical synthesis, you can raise your hand and ask for it. But otherwise, I'll let it go. And I just want to think about in contemporary terms, why is it that we work? I think that people work for a variety of reasons. We work because of the extrinsic rewards of work. In fact, when Wuthnow asked people in that book, God and Mammon, in America, that was the number one answer. They work for money. We work for money. We exchange the time of our lives for a different sort of currency. When we ask someone at a party, do you work? We don't mean, do you perform socially useful activity? We mean, do you do something, socially useful or not, for money? We spend time at work to get money to spend in consumer society. We work for our families also. In this country, we find that we need to work to support our families. Historically, men have worked for money while women worked for the family and the household itself. Historians have identified what they call a cult of true womanhood, a cultural ideal which told women from about the 1830s on that they should be pious, pure, and submissive, serving husbands and children in the home. Less known, but no less important, was what I would call a cult of true manhood, which said basically that a man was not a man if he could not support a family. And I think this cult of true manhood is still there. I think it's still very strong, and I think it also is part of the problem, that men find it very difficult for reasons of identity in this cult of true manhood to cut down on work. The historical roots of this cult of true manhood are quite deep. In my life, it showed up early in my marriage when I was in graduate school and making, at most, $3,000 a year. My father-in-law used to ask me, with some seriousness, what I was going to do when I grew up. He wasn't real fond of me in the beginning. He got to like me over time, but I was sort of not his choice. The other person that Barb had been dating before was a pre-med, and that looked a lot more attractive to him than me. But anyway, he would ask me what I was going to do when I grew up. He did not mean what was I going to do for fun, or how would I keep fit, or where I might travel. He meant, what are you going to do to make enough money to support my daughter in the style to which she'd like to become accustomed? And that was it. So our families, therefore, can sometimes trap us into patterns of work that prove pathological, especially when we become accustomed to styles of consumption that consume us at work. I mean, I think there are people who have a certain level of income now, a certain style of living, who really are feeling overworked, who are feeling the pressures of work, who are feeling stressed by work, would like to cut back, but they don't want to say to their kids, you know, well, we need to give up some of this stuff in order to do that. Or they don't want to say to their spouse, you know, I don't think that I want to keep going at this pace. And I think particularly as people get worried about retirement, it's a, you know, again, that's a kind of family pressure. How are we going to spend time together when we no longer have incomes from jobs? It means that you have to keep working pretty hard and in a pretty stressed fashion in order to put together the money that you might need for retirement. So we work for money, we work for families. In this culture, even more deeply, we work for our identity. In this culture, you are what you do, especially at work. When I am introduced to audiences, when I give talks and things like that, nobody talks about my basketball career, which is largely just pickup basketball games, or my hobbies or my religious persuasion. You know, even here at Holden Village, people wouldn't say, this is Jim Farrell, he's a Catholic. They would say, this is Jim Farrell, he's a college professor. Our identity is very much wrapped up in what we do. At a cocktail party, watch and see how awkward it is to introduce people any other way. The question, what do you do, is not as open-ended as it sounds. It means simply, what do you do for money? And this is why women, who often perform the most important work in the world, which is manufacturing human beings, sometimes say they are just a housewife. And that just is to me one of the most critical words in that phrase, because it means it's not paid work. And paid work is, in many ways, what counts. So if we were to think about how we might redefine work or revalue work in American culture, that would be one of the things that I'd want to do, is to revalue the work of the home. And in fact, to revalue it in such a way that men would want to take part in it too, and not just women. In a money economy, and I think this is where the money economy thing comes in, sometimes it's hard to value the things that we really value. We really value the work that women do at home, but in a market economy, it's hard to value it appropriately and to talk about it. Now, Americans feel the importance of work in their identity. Wethnow found that 81% of working Americans regard their work as absolutely essential or very important to their basic sense of worth as a person. And this percentage is higher than for hobbies, leisure activities, or any kind of community ties. And it's also, interestingly enough, higher than a person's relationship to God. Your job comes first, God, some sort of down the line a little bit in terms of your basic worth as a person. About the same proportion, 4 out of 5, say that even if I had enough money, I would still work. And this is what's interesting here is that people say the number one reason they do work is money, and yet they say, even if I had enough money, I would still work. And I think there are reasons for that. Now, we know that we are what we do because of the emphasis on doing in American culture. Unlike other cultures in which a person might be defined by her being, simply the existence of a person, or by a network of social relations. I might be known as, you know, Jim, the son of Lee, the daughter of Eileen, you know, and that would be enough in some cultures to describe who I am, rather than to say, this is Jim, the college professor. Americans like to define themselves by doing. Sociologists and other Americans can calculate fairly precisely the social status of different occupations, and they know who ranks where on the social ladder. And as early as age 3 or 4, kids can also rank the status of jobs. And they know that the question, what do you want to be when you grow up, cannot be answered as simply as alive or happy. You know, that it requires an occupational answer, policeman, fireman, that sort of thing. And so early on, by our questioning and by our responses to their answers, we tell them how important working will be in their lives. Even more than our social identity, though, work creates the inner self. Whatever else we make through our labor, notes Scott Russell Sanders, we also make ourselves. So we had better choose carefully what we do with our days and how we do it and why. I think that we don't work very much for the pleasure of the work itself in American culture. More and more, says Wendell Berry, we take for granted that work must be destitute of pleasure. More and more, we assume that if we want to be pleased, we must wait until evening or the weekend or vacation or retirement. In the right sort of economy, he says in an article called The Profit in Work's Pleasure, our pleasure would not be not merely an addition or byproduct or reward. It would be both an empowerment of work and its indispensable measure. In a way, what he's suggesting is that work ought to be constructed to please people, to give them deep pleasure. And in a way, that's countercultural. Now we're in deep trouble because I've got some stuff in here that I'm going to have to read that's in my own handwriting. So hang on. This could be an adventure. The United States is a highly religious country, as Robert Withnow recently undertook to survey to see the relationship not between faith and works, but between faith and work. He found that while religious values speak eloquently about work, they don't in fact affect behavior very much at all. When asked, for example, why they chose the work they do, less than 25% of Americans say that religious values influence them, although 30% feel called by God to their work, which seems like a kind of an odd juxtaposition of things. 5%, I guess, inspired by a God who's not religious. This can't just be the way that they ask questions in a survey. Money was the most important reason that people chose their work, followed by the opportunity to use my talents, sheer circumstance, which would probably describe my career choice, the challenge it presented, and freedom to make my own decisions. Interestingly, wanting to grow as a person was near the bottom of the list. And this seems to me, again, when I get in charge of the country, and this is going to move up to the top of the list, people are going to begin to think about the ways in which work can make us grow as persons. That in fact, the work that we do should make us better human beings. Did you have a question for me?
Just trying to keep that fly away.
Yeah, get that fly away, okay. Sometimes in classes, you can get into real interesting conversations with students who have just been doing something like that, or waving to somebody on the other side, you know. And once you call on them, they think they have to say something intelligent.
I was thinking about that in terms of job interviews. I think if you say that, why do you want this job to grow as a person?
Right.
That's not a qualified reason.
No, and again, what I'm talking about here is kind of cultural conventions.
Right.
And everybody knows what the cultural language ought to
right.
be in that situation. But it seems to me that our language in that situation and the way that we use language to talk about work then shapes the work that we do. Mm. So it's very important how we talk about it. Withnow also found that people with significant religious commitment have almost exactly the same sorts of jobs that other people do, with the same sorts of characteristics, lots of pressure, highly competitive, physically exhausting, emotionally draining. He found that most Americans mentally compartmentalize work and faith. They learn from secular sources that a job is a job, period, and that one need not bring religion into the picture. They learn from some religious leaders and teaching that faith should inform all of life, and recognizing that work is a large chunk of their life, they realize that there should be some connections. But they also hear religious people saying that they keep the two in separate compartments. And so receiving mixed signals, they sort them, it seems, and keep them in different files. My work is over here, my faith is over here. Every once in a while they might bump together, but for the most part, not. Religious people experience the same job stresses as other Americans, but interestingly enough, in general, they are more satisfied with their jobs than other Americans, because religion provides ways of dealing with stress. Prayer, meditation, counseling, therapy that comes from a network or a community that you're involved in when you're involved in a church, informal support groups, and last but not least, a center in their lives.
Well, that was the question I was going to ask. One way would be to say religion really gives you a way to relieve the stress. The other would be to say religion gives you a way to make meaning, to make what you're doing meaningful.
Right.
Which is less a therapeutic and more an interpretive reason.
Yeah. Although I think as Wozniak hears it, he hears more of a therapeutic role for religion.
So that's Wozniak's conclusion.
Yeah. Only a third of Americans feel called by God to their work. Almost half of people who attend religious services weekly do, but their sense of a calling is not real clear. The dominant sense is utilitarian. People are called to use their talents and to be useful to one another. But a second sense stresses introspective meanings, that God wants me to have a job that makes me happy. People with a calling are more likely than others to value getting in touch with their feelings, exploring their own self, and working on their emotional life. Wozniak suggests that this is because contemporary religion is primarily therapeutic, emphasizing counseling, personal adjustment, self-esteem, and simply feeling good about oneself. Religion in relation to work seems not to affect our behavior, the work we do, or how we do it, but it does seem to help justify that work to ourselves. People believe that God is interested in their happiness, and so if they engage in the pursuit of happiness at work or elsewhere, they are following God's desires. And we'll see a similar situation on Friday when we go shopping. This is one of the ways that we work with our materialism. This page, which I'm going to skip, is a long page, which if you were at the session on time, I talked through, talking about the ways in which Americans are the world's workaholics. We work more than anybody but the Japanese. The amount of time that we've been working has been increasing since the 1970s. The Japanese amount of time has been going down, but we're putting in tremendous amount of times at work. And it seems to me that there are lots of social consequences to that, because the time we put in at work is time not spent other ways. And that's where I think something like the decline of family, decline of community is integrally related to our work lives, and that we need to have a national conversation about work, not just the quantities of it, but the quality of it as well. And it seems to me that the downsizing that's been going on in recent years is a way of getting people to work longer and longer, to perform, you know, two people have to now perform three people's jobs. They're likely to be there longer. And so the social consequences of what I would call overwork are going to get worse, I think. Unless, again, we have a conversation with ourselves and say, we could stop this. There's enough work here. We have people who are underemployed and unemployed. In some cases, they're not skilled enough to do the particular jobs that need to be done in the companies that are downsizing. But we need to think about ways that we can get them in those positions so that we can have work more equally distributed in the society.
Have you heard of a book by Jeremy Rifkin? I haven't read it, but my principal was reading it, called The End of Work.
Yeah, I've seen it. He's interested also in the ways in which technologies are taking over work. And again, like the book that I know better than that is one by Juliet Shore called The Overworked American. And both of them are saying essentially that one of the things that we ought to do in American culture is work less. And that would be a real major trend. That would be a major shift in American culture from a work ethic that goes back a long time through these shifts that occur in the 19th century as we get into an industrial work. And then the question is, you know, if we worked less, what would we do? I think some of us work because we can't think of what we'd do otherwise, you know?
Yeah.
Would we watch, you know, I talked about TV the other day, and one of the questions is, if we worked less, would we watch more TV? I think in some instances, yes. So that when I'm talking about changing work, you can't just change work. You also need to think about what are worthwhile things that people might be doing otherwise. And one of the things, for example, they might be doing is volunteer work and community work.
Yeah.
But again, I don't think there's an ethic for that now because people essentially have, they don't have the time for it now. And so there's not that much promotion of volunteering.
So when you're saying we work too much, you're talking about employment.
Employment, and then I would also combine that, as I will in a minute here, with housework. And suggest that the real burden falls on women because they are now in the sort of paid workforce much more than they ever have been in history, and they are working what Arlie Hochschild calls the second shift, that they work another whole month doing housework that their husbands don't do. The other day when I was talking about leisure, married women have less leisure than anybody else in American culture. And the reason is that the men and women are not yet equally dividing housework. The men think they are often, but when sociologists sort of do an accounting of what is being done in the family, it's very seldom the case that even a man who thinks that he's doing half the housework is doing anywhere close to that. The proportions are still between 70% and 80% on the average that women do the housework. Is there a question coming over there?
No, I was just asking if you were going to, because you listed all those books there. He said when he had read it, when he was reading it, it was pretty terrifying. I didn't quite understand why, but he said that the options that Rifkin lays out is that as the population increases, there's a limited amount of work, and if we don't agree to divide it up, we're going to create a split in society, which will be pretty horrendous. You'll have those people who have the job skills and the money, and those who don't, create sort of a horrifying vision of the future, armed wall cities.
Well, I mean, we're there. I mean, in my suburb, outside of Minneapolis, there is a walled community where there's a checkpoint as you go into it, and there's private police force, private roads, the whole thing. In Minneapolis, I don't think people are there because they fear being attacked, but they do have security concerns that make that an attractive proposition for them. And if you pay attention to residential patterns, we are in fact residentially segregating our cities so that people without jobs live in the central cities and people with them live on the periphery. Since the 1950s, almost three quarters of American jobs have been created in the suburbs. So you need to have a car, you need to have mobility in order to get to those jobs. And mass transit has been going down. So the people in the inner cities are in a position where it's very hard for them to get the work that's being created. In our suburb, there's actually a shortage of workers in our suburb. They've had to take all kinds of private initiatives to do bus service out there in order to get workers from the inner city out to Eden Prairie. But they, like the McDonald's in our town pays more than the McDonald's in Minneapolis because there aren't enough workers to do that kind of work out there. But we simply need to get the people where the jobs are to some extent. Okay. Oh, shoot, I forgot my handouts. This is another... Sort of what happens to college professors, I guess. I have these wonderful handouts, these terrific cartoons, which I'm going to now refer to, and you're not going to have them.
Where are they?
They're on one of the shelves in my room there. Pardon me?
Tell them what color.
They're white, and they're all cartoons.
How will I know from tomorrow's cartoons?
Well, there'll be ones on work. and Bruce?
Yeah.
There's also a handout, there's some questions from the back of Matthew Fox's book, but the two of them should be together.
Okay.
My God, first time a lawyer ever did anything for me. For free, right. Actually, this is not true. I'm married to a lawyer. I had to put that on the tape. It has to be on there because she may listen to this at some time. Our marriage is sort of my introduction to the adversary process. Anyway, the cartoons that you're going to get a chance to look at, if Bruce finds them and returns in time, suggest that many Americans don't like work. their cartoons that one of them shows, I think, Dilbert in bed rolling over and cursing because he's got to go to work, and then he realizes that it's Saturday, and he sort of prays a blessing that now it's Saturday. And then there are a couple of them about Monday, about how Monday is the worst day of the week. And in fact, when you do polls of Americans, the favorite days of the week, I think, are in order, are Friday, Sunday, Saturday. Friday because it's the end of the work week.
Interesting thing about Dilbert, do you know the history of that cartoon?
Yeah, but go ahead, you probably know better than I do.
A friend at church who worked with the cartoonist.
Scott Adams.
Yeah, Scott Adams, and he started doodling. It started as doodling at work.
Oh, good.
On the job.
Well, see.
On the job.
In my conception of things, and when I get down a little farther here now, I'm going to distinguish between job and career and vocation. It would seem to me that doodling is vocation, and that's a kind of calling. So I guess I would support doodling on a job, particularly if it results in something as good as Dilbert. But anyway, a lot of people don't like work, I think. You don't very often hear people say, I get to go to work today. Usually the verb that you hear is, I have to go to work. Or if it's a weekend and somebody's got to go into the office, I have to go into the office today. People don't very often say, I get to go into the office. And this suggests, our language suggests to me that work has some negative connotations. Take this job and shove it was a popular country song several years ago. Well, why is this? To some extent, I think it's because of a long cultural tradition of the curse, which is that work is the curse of original sin. But the curse is only part of our genesis, as Dorothy Suella, I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name right or not. You say it, I'll just say Dorothy. Reminds us, Adam and Eve were commanded to work before the fall, tending the garden, and they were to be co-creators with God. To some extent, we don't like work, as Barry suggests, because we have taken the pleasure out of work. We have made work so specialized that we are alienated from the process of work and from the product of it. Very few of us perform tasks that are inherently meaningful, that are complete actions where you sort of go through the whole process of things. Most of us are cogs in a bureaucracy that functions impersonally, which in a bureaucracy is supposed to do. I'm always worried that people don't understand bureaucracy when they say people are so impersonal. Bureaucracies are supposed to be impersonal. Everybody's supposed to get treated the same. That's the rule of them. No personal preferences in a bureaucracy. We are producers of parts, and our pleasure is therefore partial. Very few of us produce something in such a way that we can see the pleasure of the persons that we produce it for. Teaching is an exception to this rule because you always get the student's response, even when it isn't positive, when they drift off to sleep in there. And in part, I think that this partiality of things is because of the scale of work. We've gone to have giant factories and things like that. And it may be that we want to think about smaller scales for work. And I particularly invite those of you who work here at Holden, in whatever capacity, to think about the work of Holden and the way that works as a counterpoint to these different kinds of work. Is it more inherently satisfying to do the work that we do here at Holden? To me, don't tell Ned this, but or the new Garbo Queen. Garbo wasn't that bad. I mean, I really had a sense that I'm doing something for a community that's here. Every day at lunch or breakfast or something like that, I can see the people that I'm doing it for. It seems to me to be something that has to do with the sort of ecological principles that I believe in. It has a kind of meaning to it that Garbo sort of abstractly wouldn't have to me. And I don't think I'd want to be a full-time garbage collector. I think that the fact that Garbo gets distributed at this community is real important. And I've told several people since I've been here that I really think it's important that the teaching staff get assigned to distributing and to Garbo. Because at our colleges, we get treated sort of like prima donnas a lot of the times. So we're sort of the top of the pecking order, and it's important for us to see the other work that goes on. But anyway, think about that. And in a way, part of what I want to suggest here is that there is always alienated work. I don't think it's possible to make it work so that everybody kind of goes yippee when they go out the door to go to work. But I do think it's possible to share that work. We could say, this work here seems to be particularly alienated, and that may be why Holden does Garbo in a kind of collective way, rather than gardens and rounds. because it's maybe Garbo is the most alienating work that we could do here.
Well,
I don't know about that, but this seems to be a possibility.
But other jobs that get distributed are, of course, the ones that people think are really good, so that worship leadership is distributed.
Right. But anyway, I would suggest that Holden might be a model for, to some extent, thinking about how work might work better than it does. But anyway, now I'm back to why people don't like to work, and now you have the cartoons to think about while we're here. I think to some extent it's been useful to take the pleasure out of work because it's easier than to sell us pleasure on the weekends. Think of how many ads contrast the pain of a job with the pleasures of consumption. It's Miller time. Miller time is the time after work. Weekends were made for Michelob. I think all of those kinds of things suggest an important sort of a cultural importance to making work difficult and unpleasurable, because then it's easier to sell us stuff that would give us pleasures. And I think in a way TV works that way too. I think if our work were more pleasurable, TV would not be as attractive to us as it is. To some extent, I think that we do not enjoy work because we do not find it intrinsically meaningful. We are masters of technique. We have the know-how to do our jobs well, but we don't have the know-why. We need to think about why is this job necessary to human happiness. And I think there we need to turn away from the language of utilitarian individualism, which I think is the language that largely governs our jobs, the language of I need this job because I need an income, and to think of jobs in a more communitarian way. For many of us, work is not pleasurable because it doesn't help us grow. It may help us get promoted, but it doesn't promote our humanity. Too often, jobs are dehumanizing instead of humanizing. We focus too much on the work to be done and not enough on what is done to us by the work. And here, I think sort of in the many workplaces, you have a kind of specialization in hierarchy that carries over into politics and policy, and that keeps all of us sort of isolated from each other. And in Catholic social teaching, at any rate, there's a sense that this is simply not right, that the first thing to think about in work is the person. Because we don't like work, we have both at home and at work an array of labor-saving devices. Judging by how we spend money, says Scott Russell Sanders, we are far more intent on saving labor than on saving our souls. The drift of our society as a whole seems to be toward an electronic Garden of Eden, in which all one's needs would be filled through shopping channels or malls, and one's toughest choices would be to push buttons and stare at screens and chew. Instead of the exertion of work, we have created the exertion of the workout. If we are to sweat, says Sanders, we prefer doing so in health spas or on jogging tracks or beaches, an expensive sort of sweat aimed at making us look good in swimsuits rather than in heaven. The less we toil to provide for a living, the more we toil to prevent dying. And I think we do these labor-saving devices because work is alienating for us. The kind of labor that we do isn't that intrinsically interesting, so we might as well find devices that get rid of it. An alternative to that would be what Ivan Illich calls tools for conviviality. Can we think of tools that we could use on this job, not to get the work done more quickly in terms of human exertion, but to get the job done in a way that leads to more conviviality, more interchange of the people on the job? And to some extent, this is happening in American industry as you start moving to team projects and things like that. Those are kinds of tools for conviviality. And again, you could think of, and tools for conviviality work well with labor-intensive systems where you're going to have a lot of people working and a lot of people doing a particular kind of work. So garbology is, in a way, a tool for conviviality. Although at the time of the morning that it occurs, it wasn't all that convivial this morning. We were friendly, but I wouldn't say we were convivial. But there were six of us doing it. And so, you know, when you're standing around sorting all the paper, we could have had a conversation if we wanted to. And maybe if we'd known each other over time, we would have. But we didn't. I talked a little bit earlier about the social effects of work, and I just want to very quickly again say that we need to think about overwork or overemployment, unemployment and underemployment. Those are all important things, and it seems to me that we need to balance out between the overemployment and the under and unemployment. because that's an important thing. Near the end here, I want to think about good work. What would good work look like? What are the characteristics of the work we love? To love any sort of work, says Sanders, may seem an odd emotion in a country where bumper stickers proclaim that work is a four-letter word. But Dorothy
Zola,
is that right? Close.
Says that
good work includes three things, and at least in her sort of list of things. She says, first of all, it's self-expression, and that's in answer to the question, what does this work do to the worker? And this gives us an opportunity to use our gifts and talents to the fullest and for the best ends. She says, we must not settle for less than work that is good for the worker. That's the first criterion. She says, work is not primarily a thing one does to live, but the thing one lives to do. It is or should be the full expression of the worker's faculties, the thing in which he or she finds spiritual, mental, and bodily satisfaction, and the medium in which he or she offers him or herself to God. I'm changing these as I go along here. We should no longer think of work as something that we hasten to get through in order to enjoy our leisure. We should look on our leisure as the period of changed rhythm that refreshed us for the delightful purpose of getting on with our work. And here the word, we would have to go to the root of the word recreation. We think of it now as sort of just sort of playing around, but it means recreation, that we're recreated now for this work of creation, which is the work that we do. Her second criterion is social relatedness. How does this work relate the person to the community? Or in the terms that I used earlier, what in the world is it good for? Or what good is it for the world, including the second and the third world? In good work, she says, we participate in the flow of teaching and learning, of making our contributions and receiving the contributions of others, of being needed and having our needs met. And her third criterion is reconciliation with nature. What good is this work for the natural world? How does our work advance the work of creation, of God's creation? How does it replenish the earth? To go back to that Genesis thing that I was talking about last week, where the command in Genesis to replenish the earth. And this is why I think Garbo was satisfying to me, because it had something to do with that replenishment of the earth. I like those criteria very much for work. While I was on the plane coming out here, I decided I would just sort of brainstorm another list of my own that are sort of overlap with hers. But let me pass that on. It seems to me that good work should be a healing art, that it should make things whole. It should make human beings whole. It should make the creation whole. It seems to me that good work needs to be shared and interpersonal, requiring whole persons, or at least a reasonable facsimile of whole persons, to interact. The harder the work, the more broadly it should be shared, and the more it should be done cooperatively. Good work, I think, should allow persons to delight in the exercise of their gifts. And it ought to give them time to actually think about what those gifts are, too. I've actually talked to two people here at Holden who are taking a year of discernment to think about what their gifts would lead them to in terms of a vocation. This is a fairly rare thing, I think, in American culture that people think that long about it. I know St. Olaf graduates tend in April and May of the year that they're going to graduate to sort of send out resumes anywhere and in this job market hoping that they'll get anything, but it doesn't have a whole lot to do with the particular gifts that they might have. Good work should make the worker more human and humane and should have intrinsic satisfactions. It should benefit the community. It should allow us to practice our faith. Sanders says, the old theological debate as to whether salvation is to be gained by works or by faith begins from a false dichotomy. Faith concerns our sense of what is real, what is valuable, what is holy. Work is how we act out that faith. And he quotes Thomas Merton about the Shaker craftsmen who make that sort of really elegant, simple furniture. Merton said, one feels that for the Shaker craftsmen, love of God and love of truth in one's own work came to the same thing, and that work itself was a prayer, a communion with the inmost spiritual reality of things, and so with God. Now, I think that we need a way of thinking about work that avoids the negative connotations that we've socially constructed. In fact, as I'll talk about tomorrow a little bit, one of the worst things about school is that students think it's work. And work has all the negative connotations in American culture that it does, and so they immediately assume that if it's work, it's going to be alienating, and therefore they want to get out of it and do as little of it as they can. And and resist it, which sort of, given the structure of work that we have now, is smart. I mean, this is a mark of intelligence. Also, given the structure of schools that we have, as I'll suggest tomorrow, it's also smart for them to be resisting. I know my first son went to an open school in Minneapolis where for the first 3 years they told the kids they were playing. Let's play at this, let's play with these books, let's mess around with these. They never used the word work until third grade. And in third grade, he got a substitute teacher in that school, and she used the word work all the time. And he just turned off. You could just see it happen, because now this was something else. He knew the cultural meaning of work. He knew that it wasn't supposed to be satisfying, intrinsically satisfying. And even though he was a good student for third grade, he wasn't getting at all the same satisfaction that he was at that time. And we had a similar transition in sixth grade where we moved and he got into another school. In the open school, they did almost everything cooperatively and hands-on. You know, we moved him into a sort of a typical suburban school where they do everything individually and competitively. He hated it. He hated it so much that we had to get him counseling through the year to get him into it. And you couldn't say to him, well, John, this is really important for you because this is the way that things ought to be done. You'd have to say to him, John, you're just going to have to bear with it because this is where we live and you're going to have to get through this school. And in 6 years, you can go to the para-college at St. Olaf, where you can do things on your own again the way that you were used to it. But it was really unfortunate that he's in a circumstance where you have to tell him you're in a dysfunctional situation and you just have to adjust to that dysfunction for a while.
Jim, maybe you're going to talk about this tomorrow, but what about Montessori school? They call everything work. And it's kind of to take the other approach, I think.
Right.
Everything they do is work.
Depends on how they construe work and how broadly that term covers. I don't know the Montessori schools that much. If work means something like vocation, then I would say fine. If it means something like job,
it's that everything that it means, that sort of self-expression, that what you do is your work.
Yeah.
So now you do artwork, and then you do cutting work, and then you do that work.
Yeah.
It's all work.
That seems all right to me, although I still prefer play. I mean, when I tell people what I do, I'd rather tell them I'm playing, because for the most part, that's...
Do you tell your students, when they write their paper, that this should be all play?
I do. I tell them, I very, very seriously I tell them that, because otherwise you get these really dull, dumb papers that are written in what I call the, or what actually they call for me, the documentary voice. And one student described this for me. She said, when you have to write a term paper in college, what you do is you turn on this machine in your head and you turn the crank and out comes academic prose. And academic prose then is mechanical and not at all related to the person who wrote it. So almost all of my assignments are personal assignments in the school so that they are doing something that relates to themselves. And I tell them that, the best way to do research is to play. And I'll give them some examples from my research. I'll give you one example now. The first book that I did was one on death and dying. It was sort of a history of the way that Americans thought and acted about death between 1850 and 1920. It's called
You Played Dead for One.
Yeah, pardon me?
I played dead, right.
In the course of doing this research, I was interested to find that this was the period of time in which these things were invented that are called funeral parlors. I thought, this is a very interesting kind of thing. And I just started playing with the word parlor. Where else does the word parlor get used? I thought, ice cream parlor. Is there a relationship between ice cream parlors and funeral parlors? So I played with that. It turns out, no, there's no relationship between ice cream parlors and funeral parlors. But then what I discovered is that there is, in fact, a relationship between funeral parlors and home parlors. The domestic parlor was a thing that in the 19th century that was under attack for being too formal and too foreign for America. And they wanted to replace it with a room that was less formal and more American. And the word they chose for it was the living room. The parlor would have, in any middle-class home in the 19th century, been the room that you had funerals out of and all kinds of formal affairs. But it wasn't used very much. It was closed off most of the time, usually kept dark. The Bible was also in there, usually, which suggests a kind of relation of the middle-class family to religion, I think. But so I just sort of playing with this idea of parlor. Then I had done that. Then I started reading magazines of the funeral trade in the late 19th century. Monument Builder, Park and Cemetery. The funeral industry had one that was called Casket. and so I read Casket, and then they had another one that was called Sunnyside, and those two have now merged, and they're actually still a magazine. Casket and Sunnyside is one of the magazines of the funeral industry. But my favorite was the Embalmer's Monthly, which was started in 1892. But you start reading these things, and then in some of these they had pictures of funeral parlors, and there it was. The funeral parlor in the late 19th century was a middle-class parlor. That's exactly what it was. It had a mantle, a fireplace. It had all the knickknacks and bric-a-brac and all the sort of heavy draperies and things like that. It had stands that had artworks on them. All they had done was take this parlor out of everybody else's home, and they'd put it in a specialized place, and then everybody could use the same parlor. They could save themselves all a parlor. And so it was just out of the play of thinking about parlor that I came to this discovery, is that I don't have very many intelligent thoughts, or interesting and imaginative thoughts, but the ones that I most have, the place that I have most of them is in the shower. When I'm not thinking about anything at all, you know, I'm now old enough to know how to take a shower without thinking about that, so my mind can kind of zone out there. I'm in a fairly comfortable spot in a shower, and I don't even have to be trying to think about anything. In fact, if I try to think about it, I'm in trouble because nothing comes then. It's just being in a shower. If often I can have like two or three really wonderful insights in a shower. The trick is to remember them, as for someone as old as me now, to remember them until I get out of the shower and can write them down. I need to have one of these things that you can write on the shower wall or something
so
like that.
So the last couple of days you haven't been thinking at all.
That's, that would describe the situation very well. Anyway, I want to talk about the way that we talk about work and just talk about the words that we normally use. I think in America, most of us are happy to have a job, which is a position for which we get paid. A job is a piece of work. In fact, in the 19th century, the term job work meant piecework. The word job comes from a Middle English word meaning lump and related to our word gob. In the 18th century, Samuel Johnson defined a job as petty, piddling work. And for many of us, that would fit, I think. A career in America is the upward trajectory of jobs over time. A career is primarily private. It is a person's advancement within social boundaries. And it often leads to social and geographical mobility and the uprooting of communities. So, you know, my career has been one from thinking I was going to be a high school teacher and then going to graduate school and then becoming a professor. Actually, I haven't had much social or geographic mobility at all because I just happened to hit at St. Olaf and they have a parent college, and so I've stayed. But often people have career trajectories that take them all over the place, uprooting communities. A career culture requires ambitious, calculating individualists who want to get ahead, which I think is an interesting word in American culture because it implies that it leaves the rest of us behind. If we get too involved in our careers, we become just partial selves, I think, because the career begins to define us and we forget about the other elements of ourselves that are there. But a richer conception than job or career is the old idea of vocation, which, interestingly enough, at St. Olaf, a lot of our students don't know what that means. And again, at St. Olaf, I would expect that they would, but often they don't. This distinction is in Robert Bellah's book, Habits of the Heart. We read that often. And to them, this is new. This is sort of, this is interesting. A vocation is a calling from God to help create the kingdom of God on earth. Vocation gives us a way of thinking about the cosmic and communitarian aspects of work. And this is what Deanne was talking about earlier. It's a way of giving meaning to the work that we do. And it invites us to think about the gift of creation and the creation of our gifts and the ways in which our gifts might be applied to the purposes of the creation. A vocation is a call from God to use God's gifts for her glory and for the good of the community, including the poor. A calling, a vocation, can never be private. This distinguishes it from a job and a career. A calling can never be private, nor can it be purely vocational in the narrow sense of the word. A vocation is God's call to work in the world, not just at work, but in all of the settings of our lives. And so if we believe in vocation, we are all at work now. So theoretically, I'm the one at work here. But in fact, if we believe in vocation, we're all participating in that. Okay, let's talk a little bit about changing work. Work, as I suggested early on, is something that we don't talk much about in politics, but we might think about a political agenda that we might think about if we wanted to change work. And I just jotted down some things that I've seen and stuff that I've read that would need political action, that would need a community to say, we now value work in these ways, and here are some things that we think we'd like to do to improve the situation. One would be a reduced work week, say 35 hours. And Julia Shore suggests this. I think she says 30 hours, but say 35, since people might be nervous about 30. Let's say 35 hours, and after that, mandatory double time. Any employer would have to pay mandatory double time for anybody that worked longer than 35 hours. This would mean that it would cost more for employers to get people to stay longer. Right now, it doesn't cost them anything because people are on salary, and so the longer you keep them, the better off you are. And the reason that employers do this is that they want to minimize the number of employees because benefits are costly. But it would mean that all employers now would be playing by the same rules and they'd all have to pay the benefits. This would mean as consumers, our prices would go up for us. So all of these things that I'm talking about would make life more expensive for consumers. And it would mean that you'd have to be more thoughtful about what you consume because you wouldn't be getting as much as you are now. And it would, I mean, I think that people might think immediately when they hear 35 hours or, you know, something like that, that we would have more vacation. But it seems to me that we could have both more vacation and more vocation because we could take our vocation into other areas.
Well, that's what Germany's doing right now. And they have high inflation and they have high unemployment now, too. And they're running into some very serious difficulty now because of the wall coming down. But they're on a 35-hour work week and even less, which is what's happening with VW in Germany itself right now. They're trying to force the number of hours down so more people are employed, but their costs are going up so much significantly higher, and they're losing jobs to other countries. Now, how do you get there? You have to talk about a world economy in this situation.
You have to talk about a world economy, or you have to talk about a different kind of advertising. In a way, if you had this community conversation that I'm talking about, you could advertise the social benefits of your product and hope that people would buy it. Ben and Jerry's, I think, does this with ice cream. And I don't know very many other examples, so I may be just an idealist throwing out ideas that aren't possible in a market economy. It may be that price makes so much of a difference to people that they wouldn't pay more for things that were socially beneficial. Although there are things, you know, like the investment funds now that are socially beneficial that people invest in, we get about the same return, not quite, as some of the other investment funds. So it seems to me that's one of the things that we want to do, or at least I want people to do in the future, is to be doing an honest accounting in consumption and an honest accounting of socially what's going on with companies. I was in the resource room there. Today, and there's a little booklet in there that you may have seen in your bookstore, Shopping for a Better World, which is a way of saying here are some of the social costs of shopping at particular places that you may not know, or shopping particular products that you may not know. And it would seem to me that if there were enough public interest in these sorts of things, people would begin to advertise that. Now, again, that's a transformation that I don't know how that transformation goes. As I said earlier in a session, that it seems to me that given the way that things are going ecologically, David Orr says this, the way that things are going ecologically, necessity and altruism are going to smash together pretty soon. And things that we now might want to do altruistically, we're going to have to do sooner or later, maybe later. Okay, second thing that we might think about would be creating the jobs we need, either in the public or the private sector. And I just made a quick list of some of the things that we might need. Design and manufacturing things so that they would last, to have people to repair things rather than to just throw them out, to have people to, say, retrofit houses with conservation in order to save energy, people to do environmental cleanup and reclamation, people to do worship, rituals, the arts, education, all of which are ecologically fairly light on the environment, people to work on railroads and mass transit, people to work on conversion to urban villages. These all seem to me to be things that, projects that could be worked on. These things would all cost us tax money. I mean, these are things that the communities would have to decide we want to do this and we're willing to pay for it. Again, these things are not free and they're probably not profitable given the sort of constraints of the market right now, but they're the kinds of things that you could think about. Another thing would be to think about time shifting or moving away from the male model of work, which is of full-time work, and to have more part-time work, more flex time, more job sharing, more homework that would sort of move work around in both place and time. Another thing to think about would be what David Orr calls full life cycle accounting taxes, so that the price of goods that we buy in the grocery store would include the full cost from extraction to disposal. Right now, social costs often get written off, and we have to pay them in terms of cleanup and things like that. But he would want to simply put them into the prices, again, kind of honest accounting. But another reform we might think about would be on-site child care or generous family leave policy to let everybody participate in both private and public life. And the last one would be to work from the example of the legal profession, paid pro bono work, to say corporations could say you can do 10 or 20 hours a month of work, volunteer work, and we'll pay you for it. A lot of law firms do that. Those are the kinds of things that you might think of politically. This will also involve a lot of cultural changes, because we all have in our minds and in our institutions images of work and the way that ought to go, and none of these fit with those images. So it would be a project, and it won't be a fast project. I mean, I'm a historian. I'm willing to wait 100 years for these sort of things. I'll be 147 when they happen, but I'll wait. That's all right.
Another option is self-employment.
Yeah.
Because self-employment fulfills many of the things you've said.
Right, right.
It gives you the time for community work. It gives you the freedom. It gives you the options. Since you're, to me, by definition, I am self-employed. By definition, you're doing what you want to do.
Right. The one thing about self-employment is that, at least in terms of what happens now, self-employed people work longer than almost anybody else, an average of, I think, 56 hours a week. Now, this may be that they've chosen the wrong thing to be self-employed in, and that there are other ways that you can be self-employed and do the kinds of things that you're talking about, but I think you're right. It moves you out of the constraints of, it moves you out of many of the social constraints and gives you more freedom in that way.
It's like taking a step out of the world.
Yeah, I can imagine it is. And you know, it's like the same way to be a house husband is to take a step out of the world, because so much of what men are defined as workers in the workplace. It's to be somewhere on a different planet. That was the end of what I have here. So now it's up to you. Time for you to work.
Work or play?
Play.
Yeah. Well, what's impressive that it's a kind of theological point about this, that I think that there is a weird theological assumption at work, as it were, that and maybe Max Weber is right about this, and maybe Max Weber is wrong about where it came from, but the assumption that the way you know what God would have you to do is that it makes you miserable. That's a perversion of my understanding of vocation, but it's not dead.
Oh no, it's very popular.
And that's one of the reasons I think that the notion of vocation needs so much help for students and others to understand. Frederick Buchner, in a place I've now lost the context, but somewhere he writes about vocation. It's the place where your own greatest pleasure meets the world's greatest need.
Ooh, I like that.
And it suggests that there's this dynamic. It's not just what you think is fun,
right,
but where what you think is fun meets someone else's need. It's not just meeting someone else's need, it's meeting someone else's need in a way that you find at least enjoyable. That then helps with some of the jobs that you maybe don't seem intrinsically rewarding.
Right. I agree. And actually, to go back to the first thing that you were talking about, that idea that in order for something to be your calling, it needs to be miserable. This is in school what I call the Listerine effect, that if it tastes bad, it must be good for you.
Yeah.
And I'm not real fond of it. It doesn't seem to me that that's the case very much at all. It seems to me that a lot of things that taste bad for students just taste bad,
right.
You know, that there are ways to do things for students that taste good.
Right.
And they give them the same benefits that Listerine would. Since Listerine doesn't do anything for your mouth anyway, it would be easy enough to do that.
Isn't there, I guess I'm a teacher too, and for me I struggle with the idea, because kids are all in favor of things that are what they would consider fun, but to me there's an element of learning which requires some self-discipline, which is not always
right
when compared to the other options like watching a movie or talking to friends is not as attractive an option. But they simply cannot get at the deeper knowledge without applying some self-discipline. That to me is
right. No, I agree that you need to have self-discipline, but I want to distinguish between fun and pleasure. Fun seems to me to be that lighthearted thing that students are very well acquainted with. Pleasure seems to me to be something else, and there's a pleasure in work that I want them to see. And I want to structure the work in such a way that they understand the meaning of the whole project, and that the project, in fact, has some real meaning, that it's not just something that I want them to do. Why are you doing this? Well, because Mr. Farrell said we had to. That's not a good enough reason. There has to be something in the project itself that suggests to them that it's important. And I'll tell you a story now that I'm going to tell again tomorrow. But this year, for the first time, we had the opportunity at St. Olaf to have some of our very good students, the Buntrock Scholars, can choose a professor that they'd like to do research with. And so I have one approach me, and I at the end of last year, we also had some money left over in the student work fund, and they just sent out a note saying, if you want any student workers, let us know. So I sent in a note saying I could use three. So I ended up with four student workers to do research last year, and I was working on this book on the 60s that I talked about yesterday. And I would just say to them, here's what I need to know. I addressed this stuff, so they already knew sort of where I was going with the argument. I need to know more about the Catholic worker, and I need to know more about this part of it. Go out, come back in a week, let me know what you've got. And I did this with all four of them, gave them an assignment the first week. They all came back at the end of the first week. And I had never done this before. I don't work with graduate students, so I haven't had students helping me with research before. So I didn't know how it was going to go. And so the first question that I had for them when they got back was, how'd it go? What was going on here? And one of the guys said, this was the most fun I've ever had in school. I thought, now this is very strange because, this is not his, he hadn't picked this topic. I had picked this topic and I had told him what I wanted out of this topic. So to me, it looked to me like this was going to be a kind of work that was not intrinsically satisfying. It was something that he wanted to do because he wanted the experience of it, but it was really my work and not his. And so we talked about it for about 25 minutes. The other three said, yes, this really is pleasurable. And I couldn't figure out why this would be. And we talked about it, and it turned out it was two things. One was that for the first time in their academic career, they had a sense that the work that they were doing was going to have some real consequence, because they knew I was writing a book and it was going to be published. I had a contract by that time, so they knew it was going to be published. And so there it's going to be. Some of their work, some of their research is going to be in that book. That was one thing. And the other thing was they had reversed the roles. They knew they were teaching me. They knew that if I assigned them to read that book, I wasn't going to read it. So they had to do it well. And it gave them a sense of responsibility for the work that they were doing that they don't normally have. Because usually I'm examining them on stuff that I know. I'm teaching Habits of the Heart. I've read it 10 times. If they're writing about Habits of the Heart, they know I don't really need to know that stuff about Habits of the Heart because I already know it. So it was partly that. And I structure a lot of my assignments so that they're teaching me, and I can't know what they're going to be teaching me. And so, in a way, what I'm suggesting is the sort of thing that I'm trying to do in school, which is to give students a good work experience or a good play experience, depending on how you want to label it, is the sort of thing that we could imagine, to some extent, in our workplaces as well. We could begin to restructure.
And if you wanted to take the analogy back to Holden, that's one of the differences here, is that if you don't show your work, the whole thing doesn't work,
right?
If you don't show up for dish change, everybody else has to do more. If you don't if you don't turn on the fan in the shower, somebody else has to leave what they're doing, whatever that is, it may be sleeping, and leap up and come running to your place and go through, and they look in your closets, and there's a real accountability, social accountability, as well as project accountability that's at stake.
Right, and that's partly too because of a kind of communitarian ethic here, I think, that we do think more about the community here. And this is, it might have been Bruce the other day that said that you don't see any paper on the ground around here. But it's real, if you wanted to find a candy wrapper somewhere around here, you'd have to look a long time, a lot longer than you'd have to look at my neighborhood or in most neighborhoods. Are you guys dropping? You guys are looking.
No, I've been
you guys are looking
I've
at.
I've been picking picking
them up. Oh, okay. You looked to me like you might have been dropping.
I'm behind you up on Honeymoon Heights picking up litter. But now.
But I found more at Heart Lake, actually, at my campus.
But less certainly than other places.
Yeah, and there are two places in the world that I know that are like that, Holden Village and Disney World. Disney World is that way because I think there's also a communitarian ethic there, and there's a kind of pedestrian, again, I talked about pedestrian space there and the way in which people come to know each other a little bit better, or have a sense that they know each other better, even when that's false at Disney World. And then also at Disney World, they have those guys that go around with the little things and scoop it in there. And their average time, I think, is like 31 seconds from the time a piece of litter hits the ground to the time that they do. But for the most part, people don't drop it on the ground. Yeah.
Well, I wonder, part of that, it seems to me, is in a lot of other contexts, things like picking up refuse is, after all, somebody's job. And so to the extent that it's somebody's job, then you have a litter. But when it's everybody's job.
Right.
Then it's a very different idea.
I mean, this has to do with specialization and division of function. There are some useful things that come with specialization and division of function, but one of the things that gets lost there is a kind of diffuseness of responsibility. And that's what we were talking about this morning, and you were talking about too, with the corporate cultures. In some corporate cultures, responsibility gets diffused so much that almost nobody's responsible.
I kind of have a theory that I feel like jobs need to change and how we approach work and the things we produce and all that really needs to change. But, until 3 years ago, I had worked for somebody all my life, 15 years in the corporate world and all that. And I just said, I gotta get out of here real quick. I'm gonna die. So, but I think that until we change how we vote with our dollars, which is really the only vote we make, when you look at 25% of the eligible population actually participates in the political process in this country.
Right.
And we're not voting there, and we can see the results in our political process of that.
Right.
But we do vote every day. Some 200 million of us vote every day.
Yep.
With our dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we change jobs. Mm-hmm. We say, we're not going to pay for that stuff anymore. Those businesses will die. And those jobs will move somewhere else to where we are paying for
it. Right. That's real tough to organize.
Very tough to organize.
But again,
I think that's the only way it'll happen is if we as a culture change how we view how life should be.
Right. There is another possibility, and it's the one that you're sort of putting off to the side right now, and that's politics. One of the nice things about only 25% of the people voting is that you don't need to mobilize a whole lot of people in order to get majorities. Now, the less people vote, the more active people do very well. In fact, that's what's going on now with the religious right at the local level. They are very well organized. They know what they want. They have a kind of coherent philosophy. And they come out and they vote. In Minnesota, the Republican Party is very much the Republican Party is, all the officials of the Republican Party are in line with the religious right. And it's because they organize better than anybody else. And they deserve it. I mean, they've earned the representation that they've got. It hasn't done them any good there because they win the caucuses where you don't need so many people to turn out and they lose the primaries. Although, actually, we have one senator
who... so few participating, though, what you tend to have is the extremes.
Yeah, that can often be the case. And it may be that you need, there was Paul Tsongas and a group of other politicians were trying to sort of put together a new middle in American politics that would be more communitarian in some ways. I have no idea what time it is.
Time to go.
I have students back here who are shuffling, turning papers, closing things up. This is how you know what time it is.
That's right.
In your classroom.
I want to get a place online.
Okay. Well, off to dinner.
Finally.
Thank you.
Thank you.